Tonight, we'll do some sharing from the symposium that some of us were at last week, the 50th anniversary of the Barman Confession. And I begin this with some fear. I remember when I was in Luther League or in high school, when some people would go away to a convention, they'd come back and report to everybody else, and they were usually the most boring nights if you hadn't been there. Remember that? You'd see 8 or 9 kids up there all excited about this experience. The format we'll use tonight is Jesse, who was not at the conference and yet remains the village's greatest expert on Barman. The reason is that while we were at the Barman conference, she prepared a Vespers on Barman to be given here, and I think she did more research than any of the rest of us.
No, not more than Jean.
Jean, you did some too, so Jean will fill in. So for, I think, most of us to begin is just to know a little about what the Barman Confession was 50 years ago. So Jesse will share a few things about that. Then after that, I think I'll ask the people who were at the Barman to just fill in any facts about the Barman Conference or the Barman, no, I mean the actual Barman Confession. And then let's share some of our things we learned about both its meaning and what it means to us in our world today. So with that format, we'll begin. And Jesse, you want to share a little?
Okay, well, my research was quite extensive. Consisted of listening to one tape, which is in the Holden Tape Library. It's by John DeGrucci, did the session last summer on the Confessing Church. And I'll just say, in 1934, in Barmen, Germany, a group of lay people, pastors, theologians, and several congregations met at Barmen, and they came together to plan the forming of a confessing church. Many people at that time felt that they were in the situation called status confessionis, which is a term that Martin Luther used at the time of the Reformation. And I don't know so much about at that time, but what it meant for the people in Germany at 1934 was that they needed to reconfess what they believed, because a new situation had come upon them that was, in fact, endangering the church. And so the situation that they were in, called status confessionis, meant that they were facing some new dangers. And what they felt that there were two main heresies that were going on at the time. One heresy was that there were other revelations being presented to them other than the Word of God and Jesus Christ. And the other revelations were mainly being brought out by Hitler at the time, that he was the new word for the people in Germany. He had the new idea for all of the people. And the second heresy was that Hitler wanted to unite all of the provincial churches in Germany, all of the Landkirche, and have one bishop that would be sort of ruling over all of the churches, and that bishop would be directly answerable to Hitler. And they felt that in light of these two heresies, they were in a very bad state, and they felt that they needed to restate what the church believed, reconfess their faith. And they wanted it clear that they weren't starting a new church, they weren't starting a new creed or a new confession of faith, but merely reconfessing what they already believed in light of the new situation that they were in. And I just want to read the six main points of the Barman Confession. Is that okay to do that? Okay.
Before Jesse reads these, one problem we have, that when we came back and realized we had a session tonight, we realized nobody had an actual copy of the Barman Confession. I think there was a red book there they were selling that maybe, I think everyone thought somebody else was getting. So the closest thing we have to the actual confessions is Jesse's six main points.
Which were also on the tape that John DeGruchy last night. Okay. The first, Jesus Christ is the one word of God which we have to hear and trust and obey in life and in death. Number two, Jesus is the Lord of life in all areas. The third, the church cannot become captive to prevailing ideologies and political convictions. Number four, the ministry of the church is not of domination and control from the top, but a ministry of the whole church. The church must not be confused with the state or the state with the church. The church doesn't have the right to rule, but neither can the state control the church. And the sixth is that the church does not exist to serve any interest other than the Word of God. And that's all I have to say.
Okay. It might be of interest that the number of people at the Barman, the convention when this confession was adopted, am I right, 139? And do you want to guess how many of those were women? One of the interests of the conference was who this woman was, and we heard a report that she was a very influential woman in terms of, did anybody hear more about her or her name?
Dan, was Bonhoeffer one of the people at that conference in 34?
No, Bonhoeffer was not at the conference, but he was part of the confessing church. Does anybody remember why Bonhoeffer wasn't there, or why? Or was he still a student, or was he in England? He must have been in England at that time. He served at church in England at the beginning of the riots. I'm not quite sure, but I know he was not there, not one of the signers, but out of the Barman came the Confessing Church, which Bonhoeffer then was a leader of the Confessing Church. I think it also helps to understand the background that the majority of Protestant Christians in Germany followed Adolf Hitler, and the church that followed Hitler was called the German Christians. And this was a vast majority of Christian churches or Protestant churches in Germany. And I think it's hard for us to understand the extent of their following. I've seen pictures where you'd see a Lutheran church in Germany at this time filled with Nazi flags and the swastika draped over the altar. It was a church that followed Hitler's racism, and it was a church that excommunicated all Jewish Christians simply because they were Jews. It was a church that dismissed all pastors who were Jewish, had any Jewish ancestry. And one of the speakers at the Barman Convention was a Jewish Lutheran pastor who had been dismissed by the German Christian Church, and the Confessing Church helped him escape Germany during the war. I think he spent his war years in England, is that right? So this gives you a background. A part of Hitler's total control was the control of the church. And so you had a minority of the church, and the Barmen was made up of Christians of three traditions: Lutheran, Reformed, and what's called Union, which was a merger of Calvinist and Lutheran churches. And we laughed, we heard the Germans who were part of that tradition, they called themselves dirty Lutherans. I don't know, had anybody ever heard that word before? I don't know, it might sound better in the German language, the English translation doesn't sound that. Is there any other background, just or anything we learned about the actual Barmen, what it was like when this, and what it meant at that time in the midst of the Nazi rise of Hitler? This wasn't that long after Hitler came to power.
Was there any relationship at all to the Roman Catholic Church in any of this?
And there's a lot of Catholics in Germany.
Yeah, this was a Protestant, the Confessing Church was a combination of the three major Protestant churches in Germany. The Barmen Confession was a Protestant document. A similar situation existed that, again, the majority of Roman Catholic churches followed Hitler, and it was a minority of Catholics, too, that resisted Hitler at the time. But this was Protestant. In fact, the confession was written almost totally by Karl Barth, the great Protestant theologian. Any other?
How were their activities? Were they kind of underground, or is it, you know, worship?
Oh.
How did they?
I get one place to start is that the people that formed the Confessing Church and signed the Barmen Declaration were, I suppose, what we'd call them today would be conservative Christians. You know, they were concerned about conserving the true faith against the revisionist Christianity that Hitler was foisting upon the Christian Church in Germany. And they were not political people, but because of this confession, they had to separate themselves from Hitler's approved church, which meant that many of them were illegal, many were arrested, many activities were underground. They had an underground seminary. Bonhoeffer led the underground seminary, or illegal, I think they used the word illegal, seminary.
What was the best part of the
week for you? Yeah, do you get a background now of what the historical context of it, so we can move on? Let's just invite different people who were there now to share what were some of the outstanding things learned and related and impressions that were made. Who wants to start with some?
Maybe we could just also say who was there, who were some of the speakers.
Yeah, okay.
There were, I think they said that was 135 original signers, of which 12 or 13 are still alive, I think. And two of them were here at the conference. It was mind-boggling to realize what age they were, almost like 31. They were in their late 20s and early 30s when they signed this statement. And they both spoke and shared. Hildebrandt was... Franz Hillerant and Heinrich Vogel were the two that had actually signed the statement and were here and spoke to us. Then there were a number of people from Germany. Eberhard Bethke, who was Dietrich Bonhoeffer's best friend, not a signer of the conference, but very active in the Confessing Church, was also there and spoke to us. His wife, Renata, Bonhoeffer Bethke, was Bonhoeffer's niece, and was there. We had a chance to speak with her. So there were a number of people that were either at the original Barmen or had been active in the German church at that time, the Confessing Movement. Then there were folks from other areas that are of interest to the Barmen, or that have found a great deal of interest in Barmen. Some people from South Africa, John de Grucci and Desmond Tutu, Desmond Tutu, the black bishop from South Africa, and John DeGruchy is a white reformed pastor and scholar who was here in Holden this summer. They face a situation in South Africa with the situation of apartheid that has a lot of similarities that they see to what Hitler's, or the situation was under Hitler 50 years ago. So they spoke to us about how the Barman Conference had influenced how they see their own situation. There were people from our society, Robert McAfee Brown, spoke about the situation of militarism and nuclearism in the first, well, in the world in general, but also in our society in particular. So there were people both from the original time that spoke to us about that and set the historical context, and people from different situations today that drew on those resources to give insight into the situation we as a church face today.
How many people were there, and what did they represent? Not only pastors or whatever.
Well, we said the opening night service, you could tell anybody that didn't have a coat or tie on was from Holden Village. A very distinctive element in the crowd. They estimated 1,000
at the opening. At the symposium itself, 350.
Where did they hold this in Seattle?
University of Washington.
Part of the interest, it was an academic symposium, and I'd never been part of kind of the formalism of an academic symposium where you have one scholar after the other getting up and reading a paper. You know, it's a
reason
very...
The reason I asked that is because you had to have a good-sized hall then to hold this.
It's in Meany Hall.
Oh, Meany Hall.
And the couple of the major addresses, the opening address and closing address, were in University Christian Church, up on 50th and 15th.
Yeah, yeah.
It's a good sized church.
So the Holden people got into this for what, $6 a piece?
Nine.
$9 a piece, and I don't know how much this must have cost. They shipped people, you know, how many scholars were just there from Germany to present papers. It was amazing.
Was there a large lay representation at the meeting, to your knowledge?
I don't think so. My understanding was no. I mean, I think it was mainly theological scholars and pastors.
And Holden.
So almost a theological
and Holden
symposium.
People.
Wasn't it sponsored by the American Theological Society?
Was it? Who were the sponsors?
And Christian Century was their annual series.
The main sponsor was the American Academy of Religion. Then the Karl Barth Society and the Dietrich Bonhoeffer Society, these academic societies. One thing we heard that the confessing church in Germany during the Nazi years was very much a lay-centered church. That lay people led the church, lay people preached, lay people did, you know, it was a time of such a upheaval that the laity of that church, and it was unique in Europe because the confessing church received no money from the state. So in the midst of centuries of state church support, here emerged a church where the people actually had to, you know, share offerings to, you know, pay for the running of the church. It was a very unique situation.
Were any statements drawn up, like, about the church in South Africa? Or any statements in support?
Yeah, some of the speakers called for this, but as again, it was an academic symposium. You know, it wasn't the type of thing that was supposed to lead up to a certain action. We would have liked to have seen that. Yeah. Or should we begin on just some...
Jackie was telling this afternoon the highlight of the week for her, and I was impressed. I think a few do that, but I also maybe some other people.
Well, one of the highlights of the week for me was a small group of us from Holden and a few other people involved in the Lisbon Peace Fellowship sat down and had a conversation it was more intimate conversation with Eberhard Beke, and he was, as Spence said, a very close friend of Dietrich Bonhoeffer's and has since written his biography. And it was one of the things that I was really impressed with, and I felt honored to be there, was to be part of sort of a living history. And I studied Bonhoeffer, and now, but the people that lived through this, through the Holocaust and through World War II and the Nazi regime, we were having a conversation with. And one of the questions that Jean asked, maybe you want to repeat that question?
I was real interested because I had understood that he and Bonhoeffer were confessors to one another. And we were there with a kind of an expressed interest of making some kind of personal commitment to working for peace. And questions that ran through my mind were what motivated Bonhoeffer to be able to make the kind of commitment that he was able to make, even into ending up giving his life to that cause. And with Bethke right in front of me, I realized that I'm sure one important resource for him was this close friend of his and the relationship that he had to him. And so I asked Bethke if he could describe some of what it was like to be with Bonhoeffer in a confessor kind of relationship. And also I said it seemed to me that the Lutheran Church right now has really lost that tradition, and if he has some words to say about that, and maybe how we could learn to be confessors to one another. That's my question.
What was the answer?
It's a good question.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What was his answer?
You can answer.
Do you want me to answer? Okay, you can fill in, I'm sure. It was helpful for me, his response to that question, because so Dan really set the tone for that question, too, because so much of, both for me, the conference, too, was so much an intellectual exercise that it was real important for me to be able to also have some sort of sense of the humanity of the people involved. And when Bethke started talking about this, I mean, I just saw his manner and his tone, his voice even change. He just began by saying he compared Bonhoeffer with what is
it? Absolutely.
No. I guess so.
Tillich.
Yeah, that's how he said it. That's fine. Yeah. And he was saying that something that he saw to be really unique or something really important for Bonhoeffer was his deep loyalty and his value on friendship. And that he said that really, that Bonhoeffer had two close friends and they were both present at that conference, one being himself. And he said that Bonhoeffer personally had to struggle a lot, that he was a man of real intense emotion, and that a lot of inner struggle. And he said that he would have to wrestle a lot with a kind of inner void and deep loneliness and sometimes a kind of despair, which he said was eased a lot after he finally gained some kind of sense of deep meaning to the Confessing Church and his whole passion for all of that. But he was saying that sometimes because he was such a powerful man that when he would be in groups of people that he could easily just kind of be an overshadowing kind of figure in groups. And moving back from that and reflecting on that, he would be disturbed by what he could see could be his own arrogance and vanity in that. And also he was discouraged at times to see how easily other people could be swayed. And so with all that, he sort of felt a vanity about so many things. And then he also said that really what pulled him out of secularism into the Christian faith was was Luther and Augustine and the monastic movement, and that he found in that a release, especially through confession, for this kind of inner turmoil in him. And he said, Becky said that in a lot of ways he was taken aback when Bonhoeffer, basically Bonhoeffer just came to him and said, you know, will you please listen to me? And Becky said he had never been trained to try and be in that position, but it evidently it also became something very meaningful for them. Is there anything that you want to
say? Oh, one of the other, back to your reference with the difference between Bonhoeffer and Tillich, you said Bonhoeffer came from a family that was basically secular, and then found the church, and Tillich came from a family of pastors and found the world. So it was sort of opposite perspectives.
Can I add something? Jack and I were talking about the same moment that I think it was a real highlight for a lot of us. It was for me. And Jean mentioned that when she asked the question, and Dan had just previously asked what was something about Bonhoeffer that was especially meaningful to me, something to watch the tone of Betke change. I was really impressed by just sort of the humbleness and the humility in the best sense of the word of him. And the first thing he said to us, he said, "You're asking me something very difficult. This is something I can't think about too much, and I talk about even less, my relationship mm-hmm. with Bonhoeffer." And to realize that we had just, you know, in Vespers a few weeks ago, commemorated the 39th anniversary of Bonhoeffer's death, so we were talking about something that happened over 40 years ago. Mm-hmm. He was talking just how deeply his life had been affected by Bonhoeffer and the Confessing Church movement. And he said, "I had always wanted just to be a pastor in town. But my life was so changed by this, I found myself," he said, "now I'm a quote-unquote professor of theology. I have had my life rearranged."
Into a German. A professor.
Yes. But that was a sense that when Jack and I were talking, that you got that sense of so many of the participants in the conference, that there had been something life-changing about this sequence of events that had really reoriented how they lived their lives and what they had committed themselves to. And I just remember being so impressed by Betke say, you know, and I think most of the people in the conference there had studied Dietrich Bonhoeffer, knew theology, and knew who Eberhard Betke was and stuff. And so to be standing here talking to someone that I had known for years through his writings and stuff, to hear him say, this was not something I planned. At one point, I almost came to the point of saying, I'm not really competent for this, it's not my field, but my life was changed to this event. And to realize 40 years later, he's still speaking out for those concerns. It was really something.
I think the other thing that a number of people said, it was, you know, it was one small act that at the time they didn't realize the full significance of, but it was one of those steering life events that their lives were never the same in the choices that they made.
It was interesting to hear them too say that, you know, you can always have hindsight, you know, what we should have done, but the blinders that those people at the Barmen had, that the resistance was against the Nazis trying to take over the church. And now they look back and see how blind they were for not at the Barmen conference coming out on behalf of the Jews. You know, almost, I don't think anything in the Barmen declaration says anything about the way the Nazis were beginning at that time to treat the Jewish people, to stand with them. Several speakers talked about that.
I think Baker talked about that more when he said that they lost track of the real issue, that many of them were just graduating from seminary, and so they had to again choose whether or not they had a choice at that point. There had been another conference, and they had a choice whether they could go
go back into the church and regain all the benefits of the church bureaucracy, or if they, you know, would remain loyal to the confessing church. And within that argument and discussion, within the church group, they lost sight of the issues of what was happening to the Jews and the Christians.
It sounds to me like, though, that their choice was taken away from them even at the time of this conference. Is this somewhat true?
You mean what choice?
Well, they were kind of, well, I hesitate to use the word railroaded because that isn't exactly what I mean. But they just felt compelled to get into this situation. Is that somewhat true?
I mean, into the situation of...
Of the Barman, the way the Barman confession was.
Mm-hmm.
To go along with it, and then, of course, that put him on the outs with the powers that be at the time.
Yeah, they were, they were, as I would understand it, they were people of deep, deep Christian faith that were not there, you know, to be anti-government, but they realized that their yes to Jesus Christ had to be their no to Adolf Hitler. But that's really what it meant, a confessing church. You could not say yes to both, you know, because Hitler had assumed for himself what the Christian church says only is given to Jesus Christ.
Maybe
so they didn't have like
a trite way, then I don't know. But my impression is that they themselves, by taking this, lost any other choice they might have had.
And several of them, like was said here, they said we didn't know what we were getting into.
Yeah.
You know, when we just, because they were making the confession, they just didn't know where this would finally lead and the terrible threat this would be to Hitler's regime, to have a group of people that were saying no.
This was in
34?
34. The year after Hitler came down.
Go ahead, sir.
I just see Janet asked about highlights too, and one of the other, there was a lot of neat things, but one of the things that sticks in my memory was that when Dan was talking about hindsight, about looking back at how that had been then, and then talking about our present situation, I think it was Paul Lehmann was a theologian who was sort of the host for Dietrich Bonhoeffer when he studied in New York in seminary in the early mid-30s. So he knew Bonhoeffer very well in New York and tried to get him to stay here and keep him from going back to Germany because he feared he'd be imprisoned, which he later was. But listen, I don't remember exactly how it went, but it was something fun to find that there was a time when it would not have been too late to have protested, but we missed it. It was something along those lines. And that really became sort of a theme almost for looking at our own situation with nuclearism and militarism and apartheid and some of the evils that beset our world, especially the nuclear arms race. The whole thing that there was a time when it would not have been too late to have said no. And looking at our own time, are we just sort of blindly being lulled along to a point where it will be too late to resist and say no? That became, when Dorothy Zola spoke and Robert McAfee Brown spoke, a real sort of rallying point or focusing point of how Barman 50 years ago influences where we are today.
I would have to say for me too, a real highlight was Dorothy saying,
a little louder please.
Said, I would have to say that for me too, a highlight was hearing Dorothea. A book of hers on suffering was a real major kind of book for me. And so to be able to encounter her in person was an honor for me. And also, again, it's always nice to see that there's a congruency between a person's writings and a person, you know, that isn't always true. And I really did sense that in her. That for me too, I know for that whole conference, she was a breath of fresh air for me. That it all did feel real masculine.
it was.
And she came up in her own unique way in a long black dress with colorful embroidery on it. and a real interesting jewelry piece, and that was just such a stark contrast to all these dark suits. And I would, for me, it seemed like it took her a while to be able to really move into her passion. It seemed like she did a lot of historical stuff that was interesting, but I kind of went on. But once she got into, for me, what kind of the meat of it, I heard that there's going to be the movie Gods of Metal that'll be shown this weekend.
Wednesday.
And a major point that she made was that the bomb is the golden calf, which we beseech for our security today. And she also talked about the symbol of the bomb as being a religious symbol. And also, she went, see, I really like this stuff, so I could just do a lot. So, but maybe I could just, you could ask me more about it later. Just real briefly, she said that it was an economic symbol and that it's at the expense of needed resources for the poor. That it's a symbol of silence, and that 42% of all the scientists and engineers that work for the military, and that that the scientists were so removed that they didn't really see the reality of what was happening. And that she also said that it was a sexual symbol, not only because of its shape, but also because of saying that it is almost an expression of sexual potency and of violence that she sees as being more dangerous.
Everybody here?
No.
Louder.
I won't repeat it, but and also real powerful at the end. Those of you who didn't hear, you can ask me later. I just don't want to repeat it for people who did. She ended hers with very strong words that are kind of engraved in me. And she said it was almost a call for a commitment and a dedication of our lives for the purpose of peace. And she said, where if not here, when if not now, who if not we? And it was just a very urgent kind of beckoning, saying this is urgency and the time is now, and we can't expect anyone else to do it. And something else I'd like to share individually, I would guess, is that I also went to an evening session that she did where she read parts of her poetry, which also was just a nice relief from kind of the dissertations that were given. And then interspersed that with some more comments and some more stories that went important to her. So I'd say that was a real highlight.
She had a way, I think, for me of showing the parallel that, you know, the reason that the Barman confessors resisted Hitler, because Hitler was a false god. It was idolatry, it was false worship. And then she laid a case out, I think, very well for how the bomb today, worldwide militarism, is a false god. And therefore a call was, just as the Barman confessors resisted Hitler, that faithfulness to Jesus today is to say no. And really came with the same faith commitment that the Barman confessors did. To say yes to one is to say no to the other. To say yes to Jesus Christ is to say no to depending upon the bomb to give me my security. It was a powerful appeal, I think, to take the Barman and the spirit of Barman and how we admire those people for where they stood at that day, and then to turn it and ask us, you know, where are we standing today? Spence, you were going
to... So just to add some of that for me also was one of the most powerful moments of the conference, was listening to her speak. And what I thought, she had just a penetrating analysis or understanding of, like Dan was saying, the problems of militarism, and especially of our society and her society. She's from Germany. She said that too often we are selective in what we'll take out of fascism or Nazism to compare to our own societies. And so we'll look at totalitarianism in fascism and say, well, we still have democracy, we still have elections, so there are no similarities in the system, and then overlook some of the other things that are growing more and more alike. One of them that she talked about was the military or the militarization of society. She says one of the key characteristics of Hitler's Germany is that in a democracy, you have citizen control over the military. But as you move into fascism or Nazism, what you have is replaced by military control over the citizen. And what you do then is you take a society that's centered around democratic values and freedoms and liberties, and you change the values to one of national security, where what becomes more and more important for the country is the security of the country, and people, citizens, are asked more and more to sacrifice for the security of the country, the military resources, to give up liberties and freedoms. And she just went and showed, you know, the trends in both Germany and in the United States, calling Germany basically a military colony of the United States. It's been so militarized that the people in Germany have no control over the military that uses their land. And it was pretty frightening just to hear her develop, you know, the parallels and realize how little control we have over military policies. And I just think of Central America, where 6 out of every 7 people in this country that have been told oppose the Reagan's administration's policy there, yet we have no voice and really very little control over what he chooses to do there. It was frightening to see just how militarized our society has become.
The other point she made was that Hitler had been elected. What was Desmond Tutu like?
Short. You all, just to refresh you, Desmond Tutu is a bishop from the Anglican bishop in South Africa, and also the head of the South Africa Council of Churches. Who wants to describe Tutu?
My impression of him was that he was, just in his way of speaking and his mannerisms, he was a very peaceful, gentle man. But he was still able to get across the horrible things that are happening in this country. I heard him both Saturday night and on Sunday morning, and he was preaching in the Episcopal Church in Seattle, so I went to that service also. And he'd always start out with taking a text from the Bible and preaching on that, and then incorporating the problems in South Africa into that. And I thought it was really neat to, knowing all the suffering and what goes on down there, to be able to see him and hear him talk about it. I mean, somebody that's really from South Africa and that is seeing, you know, knows what's going on. I thought I was able to feel more and get a better picture of the suffering that he's in South Africa.
Jesse.
Can anyone tell us what was said as far as what their beliefs are now as far as confessing church in South Africa? I know there's like a couple different groups and different thoughts on that. I mean, do they believe that they are in that state? Did Bishop Tutu believe that they were in that state?
Does everybody know what we mean by a state of confession? Maybe that needs, does that need to be still? Shall I try? I know it's really difficult. Okay. We say that we have certain things in faith, our faith, that are essential. You know, belief in Jesus Christ is essential to the Christian faith. And then in Reformation language, we have what is adiaphora. Do you remember that word? these are things that Christians can agree on or disagree on, and it doesn't make that much difference. You know, like what kind of robe you wear on Sunday morning. This is not a matter of faith.
Oh, yes,
or confession, except for me. This is adiaphora. When something non-essential becomes a matter of faith, then the church is called upon at that time to stand in confession and to announce that you cannot confess Jesus Christ and also confess this false claim of an adiaphora to be truth. And this was done at the time of the Reformation. This was done now by the confessing church when they said you cannot both confess Jesus Christ and follow Adolf Hitler. And now and one understanding of this, it should be a rare time. The church should not hold this like every time there's a disagreement, the two sides shouldn't say, now I'm in a state of confession. It's a rare time when the church says that something is this important. And the churches of South Africa have now come to the World Church and said they are in a state of confession, meaning they are saying to the White Church of South Africa, you cannot confess both Jesus Christ and accept apartheid. They are absolutely exclusive. Apartheid is a heresy. And therefore, a church that follows apartheid is really no longer the Christian church. And to be a Christian church, you must reject apartheid. Now, the World Reformed Church has concurred with the Reformed Church of South Africa that apartheid is a heresy. And therefore, to be in a state of confession is to say yes to Jesus, no to apartheid. The Lutheran World Federation also brought this up at its last meeting and will, if I understand it, will continue the argument about this at Budapest this summer, whether or not the World Lutheran Church will back up the black churches of South Africa in their claim that they are in a state of confession. This is complicated, but is it becoming clear now? This has not been done by the church. It has been done by two small Reformed churches of Germany to say that it is a matter of confession to say you trust in nuclear weaponry and its continued race of nuclear weaponry and nuclear buildup is the opposite of belief in Jesus Christ. And most of the church still isn't ready, of course, to say that, but this was a question that was raised about confession. Does that make any more sense? Now, I stopped something here, didn't I? Or were we? Jesse asked a question, and I was clarifying.
Yeah. I was just wondering what Bishop Tutu felt. I mean, what if all the people in South Africa now felt, or all the people of the black church in South Africa believed that they were in a state of status confessionis, and you clarified that.
Just a couple of things along those lines. John DeGrucci, clear that Desmond Tutu preached at a religious service, so he wasn't really giving an address like the other scholars were. John DeGrucci, the South African Reformed theologian pastor, did give an address where he talked about some of these things. And you will notice from listening to tape that there are some differences between the South African situation and the Desmond Church. One of the differences he brought out for them, especially the black church in South Africa, is they start from a different starting point than Barman did. They start from the situation of suffering and poverty of black people there and informed about that, and then use their faith to reflect on that as to how to move. Whereas Barman started much more from the scriptures and from their theological traditions, and then went from there to looking to what was happening to the church and decided they needed to protest. And so some in South Africa have argued that it's not helpful to look at it as a situation of the confessing church because those situations and how they go about it are different. But Dan brought out the point that the agreement now that apartheid, which is the legal separation of the races, and generally the oppression of one by the other, in this case the oppression of blacks by whites who control the situation of the state there, that is being declared a heresy, which is similar to what was happening in the confessing church. Just impressions of listening to Desmond Tutu, brought apartheid home to me. You can read all the statistics and everything, and that's so horrendous and so overwhelming, but just to hear this man speak a little bit and form some of the impressions like Sarah was saying, one thing, he came up, he was just a marvelously whole person. He was preaching in this huge church, and his opening of his sermon, his illustration was, he said, "I have found that when I visit many people, the most profound literature is in the bathroom." in the toilet, and he talked about going to a friend's house and picking up a comic book and reading some of these things, and then used his sermon to start that way, but had some beautiful insights. And then at one point he said, "Now you must realize that I'm 53, and that a white boy or girl who turns 18 in my country may vote, but I may not." And we've been listening to 10 or 15 minutes of this extremely articulate, wise person, and to realize just arbitrarily on the basis of his skin color that he was denied a voice in how the government carries out policy really hit me.
A few other things about that struck me. One was that I believe it's like 80% of the country is black and 20% of the country is white. And I felt like Desmond Tutu has great spiritual power, a real strength. And the other thing that I was really struck with was that he embodied loving your enemy. I mean, he really was also concerned with the people that were oppressing him.
Dave.
I have a question that goes to what I think. When is it actually legally stated?
Am I right that it was 1948 when the National Party, 1948 when the National Party came to power, the White Afrikaner Party?
So why is it taken until 1984 before the church has stood up and considered the question?
The resistance on the part of church people in South Africa has certainly run us to the early 60s. It's too bad Pat's not here because she knows that history so much better.
I'm talking more about the question of heresy. It looks like the people, a short period of months before they met, actually get the religion collected. This is 1948, 1984. My goodness, that's a long time.
Yeah, and I
also what you just said, that there was white, middle class people protecting their own turf at Barmy. That was clergy protecting their job, partially. And that's quite different from being blacks under suppression and a threat of all kinds of reprisals. It seems to be just by itself. And then the leadership of the white church, I remember in the 50s, arguing with people from the black, from the white church of Africa, that they're absolutely forward thrust.
The other thing that's happened is that black people in South Africa have been stripped of their lands and literally moved into Bantustan, which is the land in South Africa that is, it's not even farmed up. You can't grow anything on it. And so people are literally starving to death. It's genocide. I don't know what else to call it.
Mm-hmm. You pointed out that South Africa is an exporter of food.
Yes, mm-hmm. They export food.
Yeah. the reality, and at least the LCA, the theologians I've heard in the LCA still are question calling the situation status confessions. Mm-hmm. Bill Lazarus, for one, unless he's changed. I don't know about the ALC, but yeah.
I can see where it'd be hard for some of the blacks in the church in their oppressed state to say anything about it for all this time, but we don't have that excuse in America or Europe or wherever the church can be.
If you want to look at an American example, you can take a look at how long it took the Christian churches in this country to say anything about slavery between before that.
The oppression of blacks in the United States.
For sure.
Yeah. Similarly, I mean, the other issue that was being talked about status confession is the nuclear armaments. We've had about the same amount of time since 1945, since when it exploded. And we're not even nearly as close to calling that status confessionis as they are now with apartheid. Well, we're talking about imminent destruction of the world. We have an amazing ability to numb ourselves to these things and avoid confronting them.
I think something that struck me in that too is someone used the words like describing Hitler's way of setting up the concentration camps and the furnaces and as a kind of systematic building and just a very well thought out kind of way of doing that, and then realizing the same way that we're very systematically building nuclear bombs and setting targets, and you know, it's that same almost scary kind of mechanical way of doing things without realizing the consequences.
Intention of use is one thing that really struck me. Is the D'Artagnan someone that was talking about that?
Gunderson, Gunderson.
That even making bombs and you know having these targets is intention of use.
Any more?
Well, I'm waiting for Sarah to say that her highlight was being interviewed by David Soul.
Okay, you have to tell them.
Well, what was almost comical at times, things that was going on here, was David Soul, the actor from Starsky and Hutch, and he has really taken very seriously this whole issue, and is doing a film on Bonhoeffer, and he will play the part of Bonhoeffer. But as precursor to that, he was making a documentary on the Barman Conference, so they were videotaping and filming just everything. And in fact, during the final worship services, they were in the middle of singing these really ostentatious hymns, and the fellow who was doing the sound had his big Mickey Mouse t-shirt on, was running around the church, taping people. Right, taping up by the camera. Anyway, as to interview sort of two non-theologian people on the street.
Ed was in this too. Ed and I were just kind of, it was after one of the sessions, and we were just walking out of the building, and this guy comes up and asks us and says, will you, you know, be in this interview? And it was just kind of a stage thing. We sat under this tree with him, and it took about 5 minutes of filming, just wanted to know basically our impression for younger students or younger people, our impression of what was going on here, and if we thought it had any, if we could use it today at all in our situation. Too funny.
I had a quote from Bethke. I can't say his name, but is that close? Baitka. He said, you resist by confessing, and you confess by resisting. And he talked personally about what a big step it was for them back in those days to move from, the barman was really resisting by confessing, and then to move from that, and he said how totally unprepared they were as old German Lutherans who had been taught since cradle to obey your government all the time and never, never, never to ever question the government, to move over that threshold to realize that you confess by resisting. You know, and he talked about the pain and how hard it was and how little experience they had and equipment. And we wondered how much more equipment do we have. Another question that came to me so often when I looked at those old pastors, and they were old, one almost had to be propped up at the podium. But I looked at them and I said, where would I have been? You know, would I have been in the confessing church, or would I have gone along? You know, and that'd be the question for every pastor and every layperson to ask, you know, where would we have been? And then, of course, the question comes to where are we today? And then, well, it's 9. One interesting thing from Sunday's gospel, and the children I think will be acting out this gospel in Vespers tomorrow night, there's an example in that gospel of status confessionis, of the Thomas story. Remember the words, I learned this from studying the book of Revelation, but remember the words Thomas said when he kneeled before the Christ and the risen Christ showed the wounds. The words that Thomas used were, my Lord, my God. This was the exact words that you used when you went into the Roman Emperor's court. You said, my Lord and my God. And John's Gospel was written during the time of Domitian, who claimed that and had everybody call him my Lord and my God. John's Gospel here makes the statement, if you say Lord and God to Jesus, then you say no to Domitian. To the emperor. Well,
one other thing there that I wanted to mention, and that is one of the questions Rabbi Hirsch from Seattle from the respondent. And I thought he asked, this was a question that Robert and Kathy Brown was also speaking at. And I thought that he asked some excellent questions, and I just wanted to maybe list a few of those. And I think they're food for further thought and discussion. One was, his first question was, what are we doing in our churches to resist anti-Semitism today? Who are we dehumanizing? Who are we planning to destroy? What is our current idolatry? And are we failing refugees today? One of the things he mentioned was that in 1938, most of the doors of the world were closed to Jewish refugees. And then he talked about being too late.
Same session was Robert McAtee Brown said, the pages that Christians have torn out of their history books are the pages Jews know by heart. It was striking. Well, does anybody else have, you know, which you'll go home tonight and say, why didn't I say that? Well, I hope you saw this raised a lot of issues. Of course, it was quite an experience. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.